stood up here since we were one church, and that's a few years now. But as I look around, there are still some faces that I recognise, friends that I've had. And so some of you will know me, but I thought, given that I'm talking about singleness, it would be appropriate to introduce myself to those of you who don't know me and say at least a little of where I'm coming from on this. I'm 57, I've never been married. I suppose in my 20s and 30s I used to assume that sometime or other it would happen and I'd find someone. And in my late 30s came very close, but in the end we said no. And now, well, I assume I won't get married, but so be it. So that, very briefly, is where I'm coming from. And it may colour a little much the choice of the questions I ask of the biblical text and the things I find there. But I thought you should know that in order to know me a little bit. The last time I spoke about singleness, I had a number of people from the church come up to me over the next few days, even weeks, saying how much they appreciated it, and they were all married. I was puzzled by that. I've still not worked it out, but maybe you could help me and explain that one. I don't know if you've done a survey of the church to see how many are single and have a rough percentage, Ian, Cora? No. But I did it a while ago when we were one church through in the Mike and Saltersford directory, and about 25% of the people who had their names in the directory were living on their own. It seemed remarkably high to me, but I've seen other figures, published figures since, which suggest it may even be on the low side for a typical church. So it's quite a significant number. And as I looked at them and knew a lot of them, I could know something of their circumstances. Some were widowed, some divorced, some, like me, never married. Some younger, some older, some expecting to marry, some not. Some, I happen to know, chose singleness. Others, it just happened. Some contented, some frustrated. Some with children, some not. Some would love to have children, some believe not to. Some delighted to help out with children's work. Some would run a mile rather than have anything to do with them. No names. Some would love to spend Christmas with a family. Some, it hurts too much because it emphasizes that they're not a family. Some would love a singles group. Some wouldn't be seen dead in one. Then no names. At one time, we actually in the joint church had two groups that were definitely not singles. We had a 20s and 30s group with some married couples, some of whom were paired off former singles from the group, some of whom were married and came to the church and wanted to join that group. Another one, I think our official title for it, correct me if I'm wrong, was open-ended, but it was known familiarly to some as odds and ends. And that was not a singles group. A lot of us were singles, but some were married. We had two couples who were really quite regular as parts of that group at that time. I think the 20s and 30s still goes on in Myton. I believe you have one here. The open-ended fulfilled a purpose for a while, and I think seemed to disappear. I'm not quite sure why. Anyway, what do I want to do tonight? I try to help singles think a bit about their own state, biblically, and try to help non-singles, if I can invent a term, think about singles biblically. Doing three things. First of all, I want to set singleness in the context of a developing Bible story, the whole overview of the Bible. Secondly, to challenge a few myths about singleness, some of which are inside the church, and some of which are outside and creep in. And to end up with what I hope will be a word of encouragement. Now, 2 weeks ago, John Ayrton was speaking about marriage, and I think he gave this sort of overview, in which he looks at the themes running through the Bible from creation, fall, redemption,
consummation. I think he did that, at least he's told me he did, and so I can do some of this fairly briefly, and then when it comes on to singleness, I'll slow down a bit. So I won't go to all these passages, but I put up the references. In Genesis 1, God created humankind with a gender distinction. Male and female, he created them. Then in chapter 2, for a man to be alone is not good. Slight variation from the NIV to resolve an ambiguity. For a man to be alone is not good. Leading to the institution of marriage. But then in chapter 3, we come to the fall, and the sin of Adam and Eve leading to God's curse. And one aspect of this curse is a distortion of the marriage relationship, and that's Genesis 3:16. When we come on to the Song of Songs, what we have is a man and a woman in a garden, trying to recapture something of the delight, the intimacy, and the innocence of the Garden of Eden. And it comes across mostly as absolutely delightful. But even in the Song of Songs, you get the occasional jarring note. It may be as good as it gets, but it's still flawed. I think that's part of what is true of us all since the fall, that everything we do is in some way flawed. So I picked those jarring notes out of the Song of Songs for you. As I move on to redemption, what we have is Jesus, in what we've remembered here in Bread and Wine, undoing the consequence of the fall, both in individual sin, so that we can be forgiven, and restoring creation, and restoring all sorts of other things. He transforms marriage. And I've got Ephesians 5 up on that screen as a passage that would be looked at. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. So Jesus as the example for the redeemed marriage. I have to say that verse would make it very difficult for me ever to say to a woman, I love you. But what am I saying when I say I love you? Does Christ love the church? That is, I hope you say it to your wives and husbands as it's appropriate. But think what it means and don't stop. But it would make it very difficult for me. Jesus, in his redemption, transforms marriage. He also transforms singleness. And that's my Matthew 19 verse there. Now, throughout the Old Testament, marriage was simply assumed. It wasn't actually commanded. It was a cultural norm, and everybody did it, and it was assumed, and it would have been thought very odd when someone didn't. And so when Jeremiah was told by God not to marry and not to have children, that stood out to his culture. And what he was saying there to the people of Jerusalem was, there is no future. Don't plan for the future. Don't produce children. And the exile followed soon after that. So there was a special case. Jeremiah was an exception, if you like, that proves the rule. But otherwise, marriage was simply assumed as a cultural norm. But now, what we find in Jesus' teaching is that he gives a purpose to singleness. So this is where I'd like to take up and look more at the verses that I have there. So in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus has been asked the question about divorce, and he gives his answer, and then his disciples really take offense almost at his answer. The disciples said to him in verse 10 of Matthew 19, if this is the situation between a husband and wife, it is better not to marry. Jesus replied, not everyone can accept this word, only those to whom it has been given. For some are eunuchs because they were born that way, others were made that way by men, and others have renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven. The one who can accept this should accept it. You notice that there the renunciation of marriage is for a purpose. It's because of the kingdom of heaven, or for the sake of the kingdom of heaven.
This is actually unique. The other Gospels don't record it, and there's nothing quite like this in anywhere else, except possibly the other passage I've got up there, 1 Corinthians 7, which we'll look at in a little while. It's unique and it's not elaborated. But to abstain from marriage to further the kingdom. And Paul takes this a little bit further, and I'll look at that in 1 Corinthians 7 in a while. But moving on to the consummation, in other words, when Jesus comes back and sets all things right permanently and fully. There are three passages here, three different accounts of a conversation that Jesus had, three parallel passages. And I'll read the one from Matthew, chapter 22 and verse 30. Explaining the context first. Some of Jesus' opponents had come up to him and posed the awkward question of a man and a woman marry, the man dies, so the woman is required by the law to marry his brother to raise up children to the first brother. Brother number two dies, so she has to marry brother number three, then four, five, six, and seven. So successively, she marries the brothers and all seven die. And the question being put by the... and the woman dies eventually too. But the question being put is, whose wife will she be in the resurrection? Now, part of the thing here is that the people who are asking the question didn't believe in the resurrection at all, and they wanted to pour ridicule on the whole idea. But Jesus' answer is essentially to say, yes, the resurrection is real, but you don't have a clue what it's about. So in verse 30, or 29, I'll start at, Jesus replied, "You're in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven." And so what Jesus is saying is that it's not going to be like this anymore in the resurrection. It's going to be different. The rabbis of his day and later assumed that really the resurrection was just going to be like this, only better. Marriage would continue, marital sex would continue, and everything would just be very nice and no great difference. But Jesus is saying, no, not like that. Now, it's unique in the Bible. I don't think there's anything at all that says anything like this, and it's puzzling. And one wants to know, why not? What's going on here? Well, there are some other passages which would say that it doesn't mean we never see or appreciate our loved ones again in heaven. That's not what it means. But perhaps given the idea of a woman who's had seven husbands, there must be something about the end of the exclusivity of marriage. I think that perhaps is part of what Jesus is saying here. But with redeemed relationships in the new community, then we would be able to cope with that sort of, well, call it an anomaly. Anyway, it's different. And all I want to bring out of it, in spite of my puzzlement about some details of it, is that Jesus is saying that there isn't any marriage in the future. So whatever else we might say from this passage, we can't absolutize marriage and say that it's always the best possible state for God's people. It's not the eternal state, therefore it can't be the best state, and therefore we can't make it as an absolute rule. So what have we got there? We have the marriage in the creation, we have marriage marred through the fall, marriage beginning to be redeemed, but singleness becoming an option in the New Testament, and the eventual state of all of us. If singleness is an appropriate term, non-marriage, I think, is what I would call it, rather than singleness. So one might conclude from this, well, if that's what it's going to be like in heaven, let's get on with it now, and let's all get single again. Or not, as the case with it. You'll guess that I'm not going to advocate that, and that would cause all sorts of pastoral problems.
But no.
But I think perhaps there were some in the church in Corinth who were thinking along those lines. There were other things going on in that church and other influences, and they were thinking that, well, maybe marriage is a second-rate state, and really we ought to be single. So married couples were separating, or at least abstaining from sex. They were discouraging marriage, and all sorts of things were going on in 1 Corinthians, in the church in Corinth. And Paul is responding to what he's heard about that in chapter 7 of that letter. So my next few bits and pieces are going to come from that part of 1 Corinthians. I'm going to be looking at some myths about singleness. And I can very conveniently put them like that. Some myths within the church that have grown up. Some say singleness is a superior state, some say marriage is a superior state. I want to try to debunk the myth of the spiritual gift of singleness. I also want to debunk a little the myth of the heavenly matchmaker. So those are the things I want to bring out of 1 Corinthians 7. Okay, I see frowns and wonder if people are getting worried. But let's look first at myth number one, singleness is superior. It was actually assumed for over half the history of the church, and some parts of Christendom even today would still maintain that. And I have to say, looking around, there are some other people who were in the Christian Union in Cambridge at about the same time as I was, or slightly later. To me, the ethos I picked up there was sort of anti-marriage, anti-girlfriend. Girlfriends are worldly. You don't get involved with them. Are any of you Cambridge people? Well, I'm getting those, but anyway, the group I was with, that was our ethos. And I think it's not been too far from the ethos of some super spiritual Christian groups over the years. Anyway, I want to bring two things out of 1 Corinthians 7 in this connection. First of all, it's to recognize that Paul did indeed encourage singleness. Let's look at verses 7 and 8, first of all. 1 Corinthians 7. I wish that all men were as I am, that is, single. But each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried, as I am. And again in verse 25. Now about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who, by the Lord's mercy, is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think it is good for you to remain as you are, in other words, unmarried. So he is encouraging it. But when you look at the reasons why he encourages it, it's not because it's a superior status or a superior state, but rather because of practical considerations. So he's not saying marriage is sin, or even marriage is second best, but rather marriage has practical consequences that perhaps are better avoided. So verse 26, he talks about the present crisis. Because of the present crisis, I think it's good for you. Whatever that present crisis might have been, perhaps impending persecution in the Roman Empire, perhaps he is thinking about Jesus coming back imminently in the fairly near future. Whatever it was, he saw it as something that might influence the way we live, and for practical reasons. Verse 28, the second half of the verse, talks about those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this. Did I hear you say amen? I'll let you down, as you would expect. But it's a practical issue, not a matter of spiritual state, spiritual importance, and status within the church. That's what he's getting at. Verse 32, he says, I want you to be free from concern. So the number of areas where he sees that the practicalities of marriage, good as he recognizes it to be, make singleness, in his view, more desirable.
So I would argue from this that singleness is not superior to this. But the converse is also true, nor is marriage superior. So that's myth number two. Perhaps there's been an overreaction in the Protestant churches since the time of the Reformation, when celibacy was the highest possible state through the medieval period. People like Luther, as a celibate monk, when he started the Reformation, actually married a nun, reacting against it. And so what has happened over the years is that marriage has become so much the norm in the culture, our general culture, at least until recently, and especially in the Christian subculture, that singleness is seen as odd. And the statistics I gave you, 25% of Mighton Saltersford a few years ago, suggest that that is just not true, that there are significant numbers in the church. And 1 Corinthians 7 can't be used to argue for the superiority of singleness, but even more strongly, it can't be used to argue for the inferiority of singleness. Paul commends it, therefore it must be a good thing. And so it's not an inferior state. So I put those two myths together and say that both singleness and marriage are fully acceptable, equally valued, and both can be used to serve the Lord and others, but in different ways. Looking at the time, I think I can allow myself an illustration here. This is both drawn from Wycliffe Bible Translator Missionaries. Two different situations, two different experiences. One, they went as a couple with children to live in a village. And talking about it, one of the couple, I think it was the wife, was saying how important it was that they had children, because that established the relationship with the village women. They could build relationships, they could learn the language, they could do everything they needed to do to translate the Bible and to see a church planted. The opposite story is from a single woman who was out in Brazil for nearly 40 years, and she went for her first two or three terms with a partner. And then the partner left for health reasons, and she went back on her own to the village. And she said how important it was to be there as a single woman in her village. Because when she had had a partner, the village women left them both alone because they could look after one another. When she was there on her own, the village women immediately looked after her. She established much better relationships with them. She learned the language. She was able to translate. So different situations, different gifts, serving the Lord in actually quite similar ways, but because of their different situations. So I think I would say singleness and marriage to be equally valued, but both can be used to serve the Lord and others. If you want an example of a single who's served the Lord remarkably effectively, of course John Stott. If you look, anyone who's read his biography will know how much he has accomplished in his years. It's absolutely astonishing. But he says himself that if he'd been married with a family, he wouldn't have been able to do it. So there, marriage and singleness, both to be valued. Neither is to be thought of as superior or inferior. Now my third myth that I want to look at is one that I did hear it taught back in my Cambridge days. And certainly in the OM circles that I was moving in those days, it was part of the thinking. Is there such a thing as a spiritual gift of singleness? I'll read you some definitions and various things that might define that carefully. So, it's actually Peter Wagner who defines the gift of celibacy as the special ability that God gives to some members of the body of Christ to remain single and enjoy it, to be unmarried and not suffer undue sexual temptations. That's what he understands by the spiritual gift. I'm obviously saying no to it. He also gives a list of questions in a questionnaire to tell you whether you've got the gift or not.
So the questions are, I'm single and enjoy it. Other people have noted that I feel more indifferent about not being married than most. I'm glad that I have more time to serve the Lord because I'm single. I'm single and have little difficulty controlling my sexual desires. I identify with Paul's desire for others to be single as he was. Okay, so you've got some diagnostic tests, you've got a nice definition. I think it's way off beam. And I'll tell you why. It's based, in fact, on 1 Corinthians 7. So we're still staying in the same passage and looking at verse 7. I wish that all men were as I am, but each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift and another that. So at first sight, you might think that the people who were teaching along those lines were right. But I'll give you two reasons why I don't think that's right. Firstly, the word that's used here, charisma, although it's the same word that's used in 1 Corinthians 12, actually only means gift, not spiritual gift. So it's a bit subtle here, but bear with me, please. In chapter 12, where Paul's writing about the spiritual gifts and the things the way they were, tongues, prophecy, healings, and so on, those are gifts from the Holy Spirit, and so they are spiritual gifts. But the word charisma does not mean spiritual gift. It just means a gift or a gracious gift. And so I'm saying that it should not be understood in this passage as a spiritual gift at all. But what is the gift? Well, I read from the message, which I think brings out to me very clearly what this little passage is about. I assume you know the message as a modern translation. Sometimes I like it, sometimes I hate it, but this I thought was very helpful. Sometimes I wish everyone was single like me. Paul speaking, not me. A simple life in many ways. But celibacy is not for everyone any more than marriage is. God gives the gift of the single life to some, the gift of the married life to others. In other words, what he's saying is that the gift is the state of singleness or the state of marriage. God gives you one or the other. It's not a gift to enjoy it, but a gift to have it. The state is itself the gift that's being given. To confirm that, if you follow the logic of the passage in 1 Corinthians 7 down towards verses 17 to 24, I think it comes much clearer. Reading from verse 17, nevertheless, each one should retain the place in life that the Lord assigned him and to which God has called him. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches. Was a man already circumcised when he was called? He should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. Let me read on. Each one should remain in the situation in which he was when God called him. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. Although if you can gain your freedom, do so. For he who was a slave when he was called by the Lord is the Lord's freedman. Similarly, he who was a free man when he was called is Christ's slave. I think that's far enough. You see, what he's doing is setting up contrast there. Two states, circumcised, uncircumcised. Two states, free, slave. And so the parallel, working backwards to marriage and singleness, is what he has in view, two states, marriage and singleness. So I think what Paul would encourage us to do here is that we are to see our state of singleness or our state of marriage as God's gift to us, rather than some special ability to enjoy that state. That's not the gift. Indeed, just as an aside almost, I'd say that the teaching is actually very cruel. Someone looks at the definition I read out, does the test and says, oh dear, I'm single but I don't have the gift. How can you possibly expect me to cope? That is to me a cruel situation, and that's one of the reasons why I want to debunk it as a myth. I'm less confident on the next one, but I think it's probably right, and I'll justify it from 1 Corinthians 7. It's the myth of the heavenly matchmaker. The idea that God has someone out there waiting for me, and when they come along, it will all be wonderful. All I have to do is to wait for that person to come along. Well, maybe, but let's look at verse 39 of our chapter. A woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes, but he must belong to the Lord. Now, is there some water? I saw Cora had some water. Can I steal your water, please? Oh, thanks. Now, this is actually applied by Paul only to widows, and I think for a particular reason in that culture. It was a culture where marriages were arranged, and so a single person never married wouldn't have had a choice over who they married. The only choice that they had, and it comes out in this passage, is whether or not to marry that person. And so it's really only widows who had any freedom of choice when it came to a marriage partner. It's an interesting idea. But I think the principle, therefore, we can apply now to anyone who has a choice of marriage partner. And if you look at what it says, if a husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes. Rather than sitting around waiting for Mr. or Miss Wright to come along, she's free to make her own decisions and judgments on this issue. And the only constraint that Paul puts on her is that he is to belong to the Lord. He's in the Lord. I think the NIV, he must belong to the Lord, expresses it very well. So I think the idea of a matchmaker who's got someone there just for us, or maybe you told your partner that you think that's what. But anyway, I don't think for a single to sit around waiting for that to happen is appropriate. Well, those are myths that are in the church and arise from, I think, a misunderstanding of biblical teaching. The other myths I've got down there are from outside the church. But I have to say, I think they creep in as well. Time will not let me develop them, but I'll just go down and say, was Jesus a wimp? I think we've come a long way since the idea of blue-eyed blonde Jesus of the pictures in the Sunday school room. And he was tough. And he would sometimes be very confrontational. He was not a wimp. Was Paul incapable of strong relationships? Now, many people think that Paul was a head and no heart. But you read the last chapter of each of his letters and see the people he appreciated, he valued, he related to, and how much he enjoyed them. You go through, Romans 16 is probably the fullest list, and you can see how his relationships were. No one can live without sex. I can't deal with that at length, but if it's actually what happened in chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians. It's the previous one about men visiting prostitutes, which Paul forbids and explains why. But I suspect what's happening is that perhaps some of the wives were getting too spiritual and were abstaining from marital sex. So the men decide, oh, we can't live without it, so we'll go off to prostitutes. Something like that. But not true. The bottom one, I've only had it said of me once, and that was at a dinner party where the person concerned was somewhat the worse for wear for the wine that had been in his glass. But I have to say, I suspect it's been thought more often, and I even confess that sometimes I wonder about people. So I'm not free from this influence myself. Oh, I'm not. So, as I come almost to a conclusion, I would like to leave you with a word of encouragement. Thinking back to what I said about the myth of the gift, our state whether married or single is a gift from God. But it's God's gift now. It's not necessarily the one he's going to give us forever. It may change. From single to married is possible. Sadly, married to single will happen to most. It will happen to at least half the congregation. Because one partner will normally die before the other. So the married to single is something that will happen. And then that state will become God's then gift. So the gift may change from time to time, but at each stage we're to see it as a gift from God, and to be content with God's gift at that time. Now, contentment is not the same as fatalism. And I want to bring that out of one final passage from Philippians chapter 4. And I'll start reading at verse 10. I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you have renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I'm in need, for I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. Now, it's actually referring to Paul's financial situation. But I would suggest it's legitimate to apply the same principles to other areas of life. Would you prefer plenty or want? That's a rhetorical question, but anybody who wants to answer it is welcome. I think the plenty is obviously, it will be our normal. I'm sure Paul did too. So it is with singleness. We might prefer one or the other, but let's recognize that what we have now is a gift from God. But for encouragement, notice two things. Firstly, is that Paul learned contentment. That's in verse 11, the second half of the verse. But I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. That learning there seems to me to imply a process. It wasn't something that was immediate, perhaps not even easy, but anyway, not immediate. And he learned contentment. And the second thing is how he was able to be content. And that's, of course, the much quoted verse 13. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. So if I've argued that there's no special gift of singleness, I would want to affirm very strongly God's gift of his strength to live in whatever state he gives us. So, learning and God's strength. And this is contentment, it's not fatalism. We're not victims of a blind, impersonal fate. It's trust in a loving Heavenly Father. As we took bread and wine together, we remembered God's love. And that is a constant reminder to us of how much he loves us. And that everything that comes from his hand is a gift of his love. Equally, contentment doesn't imply passivity. We can actually, sometimes, do something to change our state. And God often achieves his purposes through responsible human action. I'll illustrate that again back in 1 Corinthians 7. We looked very briefly at the idea of a slave gaining freedom. There, if the slave had an opportunity to gain freedom, Paul says, go for it. And so there would be a human action changing the gift that God had given him. So responsible human action to change, not passivity. There's no sin in seeking a wife or husband, no sin in marrying, right the way through. There are four times that comes up in 1 Corinthians 7. But the only constraint is the same as in verse 39. He must belong to the Lord. So, learning. and knowing God's strength. So, to conclude, the church is to value and respect non-singles and singles. Even more, singles are to think of ourselves rightly and dispel the myths that I've tried to dispel a little bit. I often misquote Romans 12:2 from the J.B. Phillips version. Everybody loves this one. Don't let the world squeeze you into its mould. I misquote it as, don't let the church squeeze you into its mould either. And if a church is married-oriented, and you're single, okay. Don't let them squeeze you into its mould. Singleness is neither superior to marriage nor inferior. In God's word, as I hope I've shown, and therefore in God's eyes, he doesn't see us differently as in value. What about the church's eyes? So whatever God's gift, get the best out of it. Use it for the Lord and for others. And don't put life on hold until Mr. or Miss Wright comes along. Equally, don't absolutize marriage, but to seek it is not wrong. Slowly, even painfully, let us all learn contentment in every circumstance of life. And as we learn to trust God and to see his faithfulness, maybe we'll do that. We'll get there. Whether he comes back before we get there or afterwards is another matter.